Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Trailblaze. I'm Jamal Simmons, and I'm here with Matt Butler. We are the first big podcast talking about the 2028 presidential campaign, and we are happy to do it. Matt, happy new spring.
Can't wait. I'm very happy. I'm looking at the blooming azaleas right outside my window. It's my favorite time of year other than my allergies.
Yeah, no, the allergies suck. They really do. So it's 2026. We're headed into the primary, but people are now starting to talk about what I think a lot of Democrats have been asking. What are the new ideas? How are Democrats going to make the country a better place? Not just being anti-Trump, but what's coming. And something happened this week, or at least got announced this week, that might give us some insight on what's coming.
Yeah, I woke up to my email this morning with Substack informing me that I had been imported into a new list for Project 2029, and now I was going to start receiving Substack messages from Project 2029. Setting aside the privacy implications of that and how that was slightly annoying, I thought you love
being imported without permission.
I do love being imported. All I was thinking was like, oh my God, have they sold my email address? And like, does the DCCC have a Substack? Because I will be inundated if the DCCC is sending Substack messages, as everybody knows that they are relentless with their email program. But I was a little confused because, you know, J.B. Pritzker had mentioned having a Project 2029 sort of as a kind of an umbrella. He didn't say it necessarily as an umbrella for his campaign, but in a big New York Times interview a couple of weeks ago. So I was like, oh, this is weird. And I had an issue with the framing of Project 2029 when I heard about it from Pritzker. I thought that this was a combined thing and we'd be perfect for the podcast. So I did some reading into it. And it turns out that this is a completely and totally separate group from J.B. Pritzker. It is a group run by a guy named Andre Cherney, who is a former colleague of mine from the Kerry campaign, super smart guy, great speechwriter, has done a bunch of different stuff in his career since being a speechwriter.
He was a speechwriter for Al Gore, who was back in 2000 when I first met Clinton.
Yeah, and I think he was the youngest speechwriter ever at the White House when he went in at 21 for Clinton. So really good political operative. And what he's done is he's gotten about 200, maybe 200 plus Democratic thought leaders, and they are going to start putting out policy papers for what the Democratic Party should stand for and what the Democratic Party policy should be going forward. Which sounds great. J.B. Pritzker's Project 2029 is slightly different. Now, this is something, and I'm not sure if he mentioned it offhand, but I don't think it did. I think he's thinking in these terms. But in a New York Times interview with Lulu Garcia Navarro, he mentioned his Project 29, including things like rule of law and accountability, specifically accountability for anyone who has committed a crime in this administration, and going after those administration officials or federal agents who've committed federal crimes. Like, those people have to be brought to account, whether that be criminally or civilly. And so that made a bunch of news. So we've got these sort of two different Project 2029s out there. And I'm supportive of everything that they are talking about. And I really think we need to have a robust policy discussion. Everything should be on the table. And, you know, I firmly believe that the Democratic Party should have three or four core values and core policy proposals that we are running on and that we hammer relentlessly over the next 2 years. We all agree that we cannot be the anti-Trump or in 2028, the anti-MAGA party. We all agree that that doesn't work. So my only issue with this is the framing of it and calling it Project 2029. If you are trying to not be anti-Trump, anti-GOP, anti-MAGA, why are you stealing a frame from Project 2025? It makes zero sense. Also, we spent millions and millions and millions of dollars to make Project 2025 toxic. Now, Trump was successful in kind of distancing himself from it. Then he immediately got into office and started implementing many, many, many of the proposals from Project 2025, proposals and policies which the American people are generally not in favor of. So it makes it even more toxic. But now you're going to steal that frame and be like, this is our vision for the future. So it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that you're calling it that. Out of all the infinite possibilities of things that you could call this, why are you calling it Project 2029? It's really bugging me. So if JB can get away from it, I strongly encourage him to. Andre, I think you're probably committed to the to the name and to the branding. So, you know, good luck to you. I actually do hope they do really good work.
So I don't necessarily disagree with you that you shouldn't use it, but I understand why people do it. I mean, the reasoning to do it is like Project 2025. First of all, it tells you what it is, right? It's very evocative of what the actual project is. And then number two, you know, they won with this thing, right? So sometimes why do you reinvent the wheel? Like you just say, like, I'm going to, you know, we're going to have another version of 2029 because we got to move forward. So, you know, I can understand the idea of like, hey, if people are into projects, we got a project. Let me tell you about mine. And then running forward right. with that, right?
I see that. I think it's a little slightly different, though. So Project 2025, since it ends with a five, and this may be me, just me and my interpretation of it. Project 2025 sounded a little bigger than just kind of the day one agenda for Trump. Like, I don't know that people even associate, oh, the next president's actually going to start in 2029. I mean, people are going to be talking about 2028. So it's even a little bit amorphous. And I don't know, like, hey, they had a project. Now we've got a project. I mean, it's just like we're like them, just better. Like it's just the comparison. Just it doesn't work for me. And it does seem like they've been getting a little bit of pushback on it online from other people as well. Yeah. So, but hey. Like I said, I wish them all the best, and I wish J.B. Pritzker all the best. I will say, you know, in Pritzker's, he talks about accountability, but he also talks about minimum wage and raising the minimum wage.
Yeah.
He also talks about universal health care, which I think is really interesting because that puts him in a very small group of potential 2028 candidates who have actually come out in support of universal health care. So it's AOC, Ro Khanna, Cory Booker, now possibly J.B. Pritzker, and that's the list. All of the other candidates, the Shapiros, the Newsoms, the Harris, everybody is sort of on this kind of amorphous, let's expand healthcare access for Americans. You know, it got us the wishy-washiest statement of all the wishy-washy statements in 2020 from Pete Buttigieg, the Medicare for all who want it. And it just not great. Not as great. Not as greatest moment for Mayor Pete. So anyway, but I wish them all the best. I look forward to reading what they're putting out and having a robust discussion around those topics.
Yeah, look, we got to I'm just excited that people are having ideas and people are putting ideas out there because we, you know, we've gone for so long without democratic ideas. So now we really do need people to move forward. And that's going to be a good thing. So I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be a great thing. And it's a lot about what this podcast is about. Like, what are the ideas that we want to really run on and what are going to be the most resonant with the American people? And I want to have, you know, people on from both sides, the centrist, moderate, third way folks, all the way to the, you know, Bernie Sanders left of the party. So I think it's good. It's good for us too.
So Matt, let's talk about what else is going on in the Democratic world. I think there were some fundraising numbers that came out. You were tracking those as well. What do you got?
Yeah. So good piece of news is, you know, the Democrats have been kind of falling behind the Republicans as we've talked about before, and the quarterly fundraising numbers have not been great. Improved significantly in quarter one. I think the Republicans kind of in all their party committees in total came up with about $378 million raised.
That's not nothing.
Not nothing. And the Democrats came in with $341. So a small deficit. And, you know, obviously you'd like to raise more money, but it's much more on par with what the Republicans were doing kind of in the past. So that is a good thing. I did not look at the cash on hand numbers for the Democratic Party. And as we talked about in kind of one of our early episodes, you know, it was really kind of a cash flow issue for the Democrats as opposed to cash on hand issue for the Democrats as opposed to a cash flow issue. So that is all good. I mean, the one number that really popped out to me though, in the 2020 candidates is Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly raised about $11.3 million in the first quarter, which is huge. And I think that's between his official Senate collections and his PAC. And what's interesting is what he's doing with that money. And so he's given money to almost all of the potential early state parties. He's been given money to candidates all across the country. And this is, you know, a really effective technique for presidential hopefuls to curry favor with people all across the country that could end up supporting your campaign going forward. I hearken back to kind of 2002 when we were in this invisible primary period with the Kerry campaign. You know, our big scary opponent was John Edwards at that time. And I remember there was a news story maybe in the early spring that John Edwards had given 50 computers to the Iowa Democratic Party and the New Hampshire Democratic Party. And, you know, we had to do something similar. And, you know, we had to do this and had to do that. that. And it was like everything was, you know, tit for them. And that was, you know, the Edwards campaign was incredibly scary to us at that time. And that was our big opponent, not knowing that Howard Dean was coming. But Mark Kelly's doing what he is, and you will see in a lot of these other reports, and it's different because, you know, depending on the job, depends on the kind of fundraising that you can do, but a lot of the other candidates are doing it too, raising money into leadership PACs, supporting candidates across the country, and just trying to curry favor to help them down the road.
So this makes a lot of sense to me, because number one, Mark Kelly has been all over my Instagram feed. You know, I see him all the time showing up in my social media. So they're clearly, they clearly have a good firm that is working on this. Also, number two, he's in a fight with Donald Trump. A chunk of that messaging was around the fight he was having with Trump, because Trump was upset about the video that he put out advising members of the military that they did not have to follow illegal orders. So that all makes a lot of sense to me that he's used that, and that really raised the stakes of Mark Kelly being kind of a possible candidate, because now people see this guy as tough. Let's not forget he's also an astronaut and a jet fighter pilot. We are at war, right? And we just had a huge mission to the moon. So to use the phrase, the stars have aligned for Mark Kelly.
Yeah, he's having a good run right now. So we'll see what he'd be able to do with it. But being able to raise that amount of money, I mean, that's a huge donor base, and he can go back to those people again and again and again. So and then you also have AOC raised I don't remember the exact number, but raised a lot of money this quarter as well. Also, her average donation was $16.
Wow.
So if you're raising several million dollars, $16 at a time, that is a huge base that she can use to go to again and again and again to support her efforts.
Look, and there's some hunger and some thirst out there for new and different voices, number one. And then number two, people who are going to speak up and say what they think, and they are fearless and courageous and willing to get into the face of MAGA and Trump and Vance and whoever else. So that's the message to me to the other candidates who are thinking about running, is, you know, sitting back, waiting, being a little more demure, trying to play the, you know, I'm going to, you know, just tell you what I think or do something else for a while.
Yeah.
That, I'm not sure that that's the environment that we're in that's going to sell. I think people want to know, like, what do you got? What do you got to say? How are you going to fight right now? Now, how are you going to fight next year? How are you going to fight right now?
Yep. Yeah. We will see.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. So the other thing that happened this week, which has been kind of a whirlwind for everybody,
this one's not so much fun.
Not so much fun. We have had a huge scandal in the Democratic Party, particularly in the gubernatorial primary in California. Eric Swalwell, the congressman from California, has had to drop out because of accusations, several accusations from several women about sexual misconduct, including accusations of rape. So he has had to go. Without getting so much into the Swalwell debacle, and I'm sure we agree on this, that it's just a horrible, horrible story and situation for all the victims as well as for his family. It does raise the question more broadly, if you're a candidate and you're thinking about, or you want to be a candidate and you're thinking about running for office, city council, mayor, governor, president of the United States, how do you prepare yourself? How do you think about these questions of your own personal life story and the things that are wrong with it? Now, look, some things you can't explain your way out of. You get accused of rape. That's a pretty damning accusation and it's going to hurt you. But there are lots of things that fall underneath that candidates have to deal with all the time. And as those of us who are operatives have been operatives, we've had to kind of help candidates manage their way through their own, you know, personal mistakes. And listen, everybody makes mistakes. Nobody's had a perfect life. Everyone's had to sort of manage through some problem, and staffs routinely, political staffs, have had to help these candidates do that. I've had to do it. I'm sure you have. The number one thing I always tell someone, and we could talk about this, when they want to run for office, the first thing I tell them to do is, the first question I ask is, who else wants you to be in office other than you? Right? So then that's going to help start your fundraising list, right? Who else wants you to be there? And the second thing is, get an opposition researcher to go after you, to look after your life, who's going to create a file, go through everything, and then present you a book that says what they've found out about you that people may not be telling you to your face that you need to know before you run.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let's actually start just kind of one back on the Swalwell stuff and just, yeah. You know, incredible sympathy out to the victims, and, you know, an amazing shout out to the courage that it took for those women to come forward and say this publicly. I mean, that's probably a great personal risk as well. But so those women are heroes and they deserve all of our respect and all of our attention. And, you know, if he is guilty of these things, I mean, he should be criminally prosecuted. And it's just an awful situation.
Yeah.
So, all right. But to your question, to kind of take it back to the campaigning of all of this. Yeah. Opposition research book, if you're running for office, is the first thing that you want to do. There is tons of publicly available information out there about all of us, especially if you've been off in office for any amount of time. You have votes, you have gotten mortgages, you have done all kinds of stuff. You've asked for liens on your property or variances to cut down trees, et cetera. Who knows what it is? Yeah. You've had disputes with neighbors. It could be anything. But in today's environment with the internet, and who even knows how much this is going to be sped up by AI, somebody who wants to find negative information about you is going to find negative information about you. And you need to know exactly what that's going to be and how you're going to deal with it when and if it comes out. And especially if it's bad enough, you can put it out yourself. And sometimes that has the effect of blunting that attack when it comes. So that's first and foremost. You know, as operatives, you know, you have a duty to your candidate. You have to be loyal to your candidate, but I think that you also, as part of the work that we do as operatives, as part of like the Democratic Party, is you do have some level of responsibility to the party, to the country, and making sure that if your person is lucky enough and works hard enough to get the nomination for an office, that they are not going to have some terrible scandal that is going to be able to knock them out of the election. So, I mean, you go back to 1988, Gary Hart probably would have won the nomination that year, except that he got caught in the middle of an affair, in the middle of the primary, with a woman. And, you know, I mean, did not help that there were photos and he's on a boat called the Monkey Business. And like, I mean, just, you know,
I'm sorry. It's still
so bad.
It still is one of the most, is one of the weirdest things to get caught cheating on your wife.
So that's bad. But, you know, if he had become the nominee, you know, and we find out, you know, look, we found out what it takes to replace a nominee with 107 days left to go in the election. That is not a good situation. But, you know, let's say that Swalwell had been one of the two candidates in the runoff, and this comes out in October. Right. That is terrible. And it puts the entire state of California in jeopardy, or the entire Democratic Party in California in jeopardy, and could potentially lose one of the most important gubernatorial seats that we have. You know, look, in 2008. John Edwards was carrying on an affair with his videographer during the campaign.
Right.
What if he had happened to beat Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and be the nominee, and then that comes out? I mean, it puts you in a terrible position. So if an operative has information like this, I think they do have a duty to do something about it.
And not everything that is bad will kill you, right? Some things will make you stronger. In 2008, to go back in the memory machine, remember Barack Obama went through a really horrible week where they were leaking videos of his pastor, Reverend Wright, who was, you know, saying things about America, chickens coming home to roost, and all sorts of things that people found to be unpatriotic. And so here's this African-American guy from Chicago. He's got this sort of firebrand church pastor that he's been going to. Everybody's on it. You think this is the end of the Barack Obama campaign, some people thought, right? Because how does he survive this? But here's what happened. And I think this is ultimately the thing of candidates, is Barack Obama like showed us who he was on the inside. And so he took what was a undoubtedly negative week of stories. And right after that is when he gave his race speech about America. And he talked about the fact that we have all of this history and all of us go back and forth about it. But like, we've got to figure out a way to go forward together. And none of us are innocent. Everybody has something that we have to explain. And we got to figure out a way to go forward together, not just look back. And I just think it's one of those moments where it actually... there's no way we were going to get through a campaign with the first black man who had a serious chance of being president of the United States without talking about race. And Obama defined that space. And that was sort of the end of the conversation in public. Obviously, it existed on the far reach of the internet. But in the public, that was kind of the end of the conversation about the fact that he was a black man running for president.
Yeah, all these things can be opportunities. Well, I shouldn't say that. That type of situation, sort of an association with somebody who maybe is unsavory or is saying things that not everybody is going to agree with, those I think can be turned into opportunities. I mean, sexual misconduct, even after post-Trump, I mean, you know, somehow Trump has been able to get away with it. I don't think other politicians are able to get away with it. I mean, there's just some certain kind of rules and norms that Trump can defy that not everybody else can. So, you know, I don't know how you turn accusations of rape into a positive situation for you.
No, you can't do that. You can't do that. Yeah. There are things, again, that is a level that is its own level. There are things less than that, particularly financial crimes or financial misdeeds, let's not call them crimes, because crimes are hard to escape for most people, except Donald Trump, apparently. Yeah. You'd be convicted of 34 counts of crime and still run for president and win. But for everyone else, you know, you get something like the other thing that happened to Obama. Is they found out that he had a guy who I think a donor or something who bought a lot next to his house and they were letting his kids, you know, use it as kind of like an extra playground. You know, that's something that happened. You know, you hear about people who have, you know, some problems in their congressional accounts, you know, how they spend their money. You know, some of that stuff, I will tell you, as a comms person, you do let that stuff out early. Sometimes the campaign is the one, your campaign is the one that gets it out there from some other source, perhaps, but that gets it out there because it's like you need a little taste of the dog to inoculate you, right?
Yeah.
And so then you can kind of get through it. And, you know, you want to run for president in 2028, having a bad story that comes out about you in January of 2027 or December of 2026 doesn't necessarily kill you. And now it's hard for anybody else to bring it back. And so you deal with it far enough away from election day. The worst part is the scenario you mentioned, which is nobody brings it up. It's 6 weeks before election day and you're George W. Bush. Remember this, George W. Bush in 2000, all of a sudden 3 weeks or the weekend before election, we find out he had a DUI, which back in those days, in the halcyon days of the 2000s, was a really big deal.
Yeah.
And so he had to answer for that. And some people account that may have been part of what got Al Gore over the hump to get more votes than George W. Bush that year.
Yeah.
Then there's also stories that stick with you, like this French Laundry story for Gavin Newsom. I mean, just I don't know what he's going to do, but it does not seem to be going away, and it's still like people are always bringing it up constantly, even though he's apologized for it, admitted it was a mistake. But it's some of these things, they do stick with you.
Well, the two things that are really bad for you are either the things that confirm something bad that everybody believes about you already, and now they've got a really easy way to confirm it. That was sort of the Access Hollywood moment for Trump, right? Like everyone knew he was kind of a louse, and then here he was on camera and video saying it and audio saying it, or something that is clearly like, you know, it is against the type. Like we all think that you're one person, and now there's some hypocritical moment that has now just told us something about this candidate that says everything we believed about this person may not be true. Those are the things that kind of kill you the most, right?
Absolutely.
Is it confirm the worst part or tell us something that defies what it is that we always believed about you to be a good person?
It does. And it puts operatives in really bad spots. And, you know, to be able to come forward against something about your boss, like, I've never been in that situation where I've had to do that. I would have to imagine that that's going to be a really tough position to be in. And, you know, if it's the case with one of these, not the potential nominees, especially somebody who could get the nomination, you know, I hope people have the courage to do that.
Well, and part of, you talked about your obligation as an operative is if you're part of the team that's coming together around a candidate who hasn't gotten out there yet, but they're trying to figure it out, and you come across some of this information, there is another answer, which is just say no. Yeah. Like, don't run. Don't put your family through it. Don't put the party through it. Don't put the rest of the staff through it. If there's a victim involved, don't put them through it. Like, just don't do it. And we can all, and then sometimes you may have to just walk away from that person and say, if you do it, you got to do it without me. But there's no way I can sign up to ride with you on that mission. So.
Yep.
You know, it's a tough, it's all of this is very tough, but it's adult business. The stakes are high. It's not just about this person's individual career, which I think often happens as everybody gets wrapped up in their own ambition. It really is about the future of the country, the future of your city, the future of your, you know, whatever community it is you're looking to represent. So.
All right.
And poly markets, what do we know about what's happening in the world of Kalshi and all the other poly markets?
Yeah. So let's talk kind of broadly about kind of these prediction markets, because they've been making a lot of news. You know, reporters now are quoting these markets and where people are kind of in the markets, entirely. So let's kind of go a little bit deep into it. So, you know, what are these prediction markets? So there's three big ones in the United States that U.S. citizens have access to. Poly markets a little bit hazy on kind of how Americans use it. But so there's one called Kalshi. There's one called Polymarket. Those are the two really big ones. And there's a third called Predictit, which is a smaller pool of players. It's been around for a long time. I mean, Polymarket's probably been around for 15 years. But so these are all sort of regulated from the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, so the CFTC, and they are regulated that way because what they do is they operate on what's called a designated contract market. They're called designated contract markets.
You're letting your lawyer out. I love it.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the official term for it. Yes. So, but basically, what a designated contract market is a contract that will resolve to yes or no. So it's got to be a binary decision. Gavin Newsom will be the Democratic nominee in 2028. That is either going to, yes, that's going to happen, or no, that's not going to happen. So when you have these sort of propositions, these markets provide an opportunity for you to gamble money thinking that your prediction is going to be right. And the way that they do that is you basically, so think about this, is like every contract is worth $1. Whoever gets that right, if you've bet yes, Gavin Newsom, if you bet yes, you are going to receive a dollar. If you bet no and it doesn't happen, you'll receive a dollar. And the way that you get there is people put up the portion of that dollar that they believe that they have confidence that they are going to be right. So let's say that you think Gavin Newsom has a 25% chance to be the Democratic nominee. You can put up 25 cents to say, yes, Gavin Newsom will be the Democratic nominee. Somebody else out there may be like, no chance. The French Laundry is going to kill this guy and continue to kill this guy. They will be willing to put up 75 cents to make that contract a full dollar. That dollar gets held in escrow by Kalshi or Polymarket or Predictit. And then when the thing resolves and we know what the answer is, the person who has the right side of the contract gets that dollar. Now, obviously, people are not just betting a dollar. They're betting multiples of dollars in certain situations, sometimes tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you can find somebody to take the other side of the market, then you will be able to have a contract. And so this is where it sort of really gets interesting, where it kind of veers away from actual gambling. So like you and I may have a bet like, Gavin Newsom's going to be the nominee. And I say, okay, I'll bet $10. And you say, I bet $15. And we decide it when it goes by. But in these situations.
And then maybe we settle up over like a steak dinner or something. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Something like that. Okay. Not that that's ever happened before.
Right.
But in these situations, what you have done is you've actually bought a contract that will pay off if it happens. Now you can sell those contracts throughout the course of the election. So if it looks like Gavin Newsom is starting to really gain some momentum, people may be willing to pay 50, 60 cents for that contract that you paid 25 cents. So you can sell at any point before the resolution to somebody who believes that that thing is going to happen more than you do. So you've got an out from it, or you can like take quick profit, or you're like, I just want to lock this in. And it is that trading of the contracts as you go along that creates ups and downs on the market over time so that you can see what people are thinking. And that, for me, is where the actual educational value of prediction markets comes from. And that is to say that the origin of these are actually in educational markets. I think Predictit still uses a association with a college kind of in the Pacific Northwest as the reason it's allowed to do this. It's because we are gleaning information. We know in real time what people think of these candidates and where they are up and down.
So where this matters or comes in for me is It's sort of like polling. It also depends on who are the people who are making these bets. So either one, are they like more informed than the average bear? And so therefore they know more. And so their opinions, you know, matter. Like people who are probably watching sports, right? If you're watching sports all the time, you know more about individual teams. And so maybe your bet matters more than like me, who's only watching casually. Or number two, is it a wide enough market of people, diverse enough, gender, region, income, all the things that we sort of look for, that I'm getting a sense of like what the broad public is thinking about it? And I think that's the question, right?
Yeah. So we'll start at the beginning. So polling is a great analogy for it. It is like polling. It is different for the reasons we're going to talk about in a second, but I think it is a very good indicator of sort of where general sentiment is on a specific race. It is better than polling in the sense that polling is just somebody gets a phone call, does it in our online survey, and they're just checking the box for who they think is going to be the nominee. They have no stake in it. They don't, you know, they could feel a certain way. They may have just heard about that candidate that afternoon, and like that's that, you know, James Tallarico is top of mind. I'm going to say James Tallarico is going to be the 2028 nominee. With prediction markets, it is people that are actually putting in their money that says that they will do that. They have a commitment to this. And so it gives you a sort of deeper level of sentiment for the people who are playing. Now, why is it not as good as polling? For exactly the point that you are making, it is not representative necessarily of a broad spectrum of people. Like if you were doing a scientific poll, you figure out that polling universe and you make it look like the electorate so that you have a better idea of how the election is going to go. And so you basically, there's racial diversity based into it. There's economic diversity. There's Democrat and Republican diversity built into that. This has none of that. I don't particularly know who the kind of the wide spectrum of Polymarket or Kalsheet bettors are. I mean, I'm sure everybody has probably some kind of preconceived notions of who those are. They're probably wrong, but it's definitely not average everyday voters, and it's not a broad swath of everyday voters. And so these are just people who are involved in these gambling markets. So that it definitely fails polling in that way, or kind of trails polling in that way. But like I said, it is not better or worse than polling. Just the same way, I don't think polling is better or worse than prediction markets. It's simply another tool that we have to look at to kind of have an idea of where the horse race is within the market or within the state of the race. So for these kind of race, for like elections, I think prediction markets are fascinating. I think that they are a really good tool, and I think that there's a lot of value to them.
We can talk
about some of the other problems.
It could be a bunch of guys sitting on bar stools in Irish bars all over America who are like just placing bets with their buddies after like three Heinekens.
and so let's talk. That's a great segue into some of the problems of prediction markets, right? So number one, it is another form of gambling, and you know we seem to be moving more and more into different forms of gambling, whether that be online poker, sports betting, you know, all kinds of different states have now legalized casinos. So you can have your position on gambling. And I'm sure that there are a good portion of our listeners who are anti-gambling. They see it as a scourge on the society. And, you know, yes, many people have issues with gambling and have been, you know, financially ruined. So look, I get to be against that.
But when I was in finance class in school, I remember learning about the stock market, and I remember being explained to me the idea of futures trading. And I raised my hand and I was like, this is gambling. And the professor was like, no, it's way more blah, blah, blah. Gambling is just rolling a ball around in a circle and blah, blah, blah. You have a, like, yeah, okay, sure, whatever you want to say. I'm betting that oil is today $112. I'm betting tomorrow it's going to be $115. And either I'm going to make that bet and get the money, or I'm going to lose it and I'm going to, like, the contract that I am now betting in is going to close for $112.50, and I'm going to lose $2.50. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a bet.
Yes, it's about, I mean, well,
so we've had gambling around for a long time,
for a long time, and that's completely legalized and regulated gambling. And so, you know, I happen to be a person who thinks, you know, look, I like I like to do reasonable amounts of gambling for reasonable amounts of money. I'm not going to like take my kid money out of my kid's college fund to gamble it. I'm going to like, it's disposable income. I enjoy it. I think it's fun when we have an argument at a bar and we can't decide, like, you have one position, I have another. Well, okay, big mouth. Let's put, what are you going to put money behind? Do you really believe what you're saying? And if you will, you'll put money behind it. And so these give that, you know, give that a form. So, and I think I have no problem with these from that perspective. Where we start to have problems with it is that a lot of these markets, it's not just markets like, is Gavin Newsom going to be the Democratic nominee, which you don't really have, like, nobody has like inside information into what that's going to be. But there are a lot of markets that do. They do markets for like, how many times is Trump going to say Iran in a speech? Is Trump going to mention this? Is Trump going to mention that? And there are people who have inside information on that. There is a team of speechwriters that worked on his State of the Union speech. They know exactly how many times that's going to happen. There are bets kind of surrounding national leaders and national security issues. So, you know, the big example of this is, or the one that was kind of most recently top of mind was somebody placed a bet on either Kalshi or Polymarket that Maduro was going to be out of office by January 31, 2026. And 3 or 4 days before we went into Venezuela to take out Maduro, that person placed about a $30,000 bet on very long odds that was going to happen and was paid off about $400,000. Now that one, it's just simply unfair. It's against terms of service. Like Kalshi says, you cannot bet on insider trading. Who knows how they are actually enforcing that, etc. But it also brings up incredible national security concerns. So like, if you're like the Venezuelan secret service or, you know, CIA,
right,
and you're watching these markets and you're like, wait a second, you know, all of a sudden we went from 10% chance of being out of office by January 31 to 60% chance of being out of office. What is going on here? And there's, you know, obviously when we're in war with Iran, there are people that have inside information about sensitive kind of strike targets, et cetera. And all of that can be traded on. And it seems like that is happening with possibly members of the Trump administration.
And so you think,
and so it's, this is just all, this is terrible.
So think about the other
side. It's not a good thing.
So the other side of that is you're a policymaker or someone who's in the middle of this. You got a bet or somebody has placed a bet. And let's play spy thriller movie now. A whole bunch of gambling guys have placed a bet that we're going to get rid of Maduro by the 31st. And you're the person who is in the situation room who's supposed to make it. And they like come and like make you make this recommendation to the president because they got to make this bet pay off. Right. So it creates some sort of an incentive. I mean, the minor incentive is, you know, what's going to happen. And so you bet on it and you get the money back. That one's a little bit more laissez-faire. But like, if it's like you actually do something that makes this come true in order to make your bet, to make a bet pay off, that is total corruption of the system.
Yes. And especially if you've got a situation where you've got compromise on somebody or you've got leverage on somebody and you can make them do something. I mean, this is ultimately why sports betting was illegal for so long in this country, is the Black Sox scandal in whatever, 1919, where, right, you know, the White Sox threw the World Series because, you know, what is his name? His character in Boardwalk Empire. Anyway, but you know, he'd rigged the World Series,
right.
And so for many years, sports betting was illegal. I mean, the other issue is that, like, you know, on Kalshi, you can now bet on sport, the outcome of sports games and stuff like that, and you totally get away. There's no, I don't see any educational benefit in what the American public thinks about the outcome of the Bills Jaguars game. Like, I don't care. Like, maybe more people think the Bills are going to win. Who cares? Like, that's not that. There's nothing educational about that. Like, we can't learn anything from that. So I think, you know, taking away sort of that sports betting. Also, there's sports betting's regulated state by state, and I trust that a lot more than I trust Kalshi to do it through the CFTC.
And so it's, and really, there was some evidence,
people to get around a lot of laws.
Yeah, there was some evidence that, I guess, like BetMGM or some of those companies, the sports betting, that they were the reason that we caught some of the latest sports gambling scandals. Was they noticed a lot of activity that was happening on really obscure games or obscure players all of a sudden. And they were the ones who kind of realized like something was afoot here at the Circle K. So they had to figure it out.
Yeah. And then the last point that I would make on this is, what was interesting is the, you know, we talked about Predictit, which is kind of a smaller version of Kalshi and Polymarket that's been around for a while. For many years, the maximum amount you could bet on any individual contract was about $800. I think that's up to $3,500 now. That to me seems like a more reasonable way to have this. So you get the fun of the gambling, you get to put your money where your mouth is, you get to enjoy it. But like, I mean, you're really going to like use insider information that you've received at your job to, you know, to bet $800. Like, it's just like the value is a lot less. So I think there's probably ways. I am supportive in general of the idea of having prediction markets, in the way that I'm kind of supportive of gambling in general within reasonable limits and watching out for people. Yeah. So,
all right. Well, it's pretty, it's a big deal. I think a lot of people are going to be investigated about this, particularly if the Democrats get power back, and we'll see whether or not there's anything that will fix this before we get to the 2028 campaign, because you could do things like some people are arguing the president will say these phrases four times, or the candidate, you know, candidate X will say this phrase at the debate, and then candidate X says that phrase at the debate and you end up getting paid. There'll be all kind of minor ways that people may try to gamble on this and really corrupt the system in a way that none of us will be happy about. So, all right. Man.
Well, and I don't want to disappoint you, but I don't think this is changing before 2028, because I mean, like, Donald Trump Jr. is on the board of Kalshi. So like, right. You know, the Trumps are all in on prediction markets, and, you know, the same way they're all in on crypto. So this is, you know, the corruption continues. And so I don't see anything changing in the next couple of years. So
corruption continues. Anyway. All right. Anybody who's liking what you hear and you want to keep checking us out on all the platforms where we are, Apple and all the places where you can listen to us on YouTube, or you can watch us. You also can get in touch with us at trailblazepod.com. No, or trailblaze.pod. Tell me. Trailblazepod.com. I'm sorry.
Trailblazepod.com. You nailed it.
So BLAZE, blaze at trailblazepod.com. Email us if you got something you want to talk about, question you have for us. Maybe we can answer it in a future episode. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks. Thank you.